to the Vicor Powering Innovation Podcast, where we discuss world-changing innovations. I'm Steve Germino, and I'm here with my co-host, Joe Ducey.
So today's conversation is around electric motorcycles, and we're going to be speaking with Lightning Motorcycles, and the CEO, Richard Hatfield, will join us today. Now, Lightning is aptly named. Lightning holds the land speed record at 215 miles an hour, which they set at Bonneville Flats in Utah. And they did it with an electric motorcycle, which is kind of revolutionary. So the conversation is really going to be around electric motorcycles versus the internal combustion engine motorcycles, also known as ICE bikes. And it's a really interesting conversation in that Richard ended his conversation with a statement kind of relegating the ICE bikes to collectibles in the very near future. Now, collectibles, in my mind, is more something more like a Model T. So I'm not quite there thinking that electric bikes are going to be drowning out the ICE bike, but I'd be curious to get your thoughts on that, Joe, in terms of, you know, what is the longevity of the ICE bikes?
Well, I mean, you know, today we've seen, you know, obviously we've seen electric vehicles and we've seen the ramp up of that. We've seen, you know, the roads are stacked full of Teslas. So, you know, the adoption rate for electric vehicles has gone up much more dramatically than that of electric motorcycles. And there's a reason for that. If you think about it, an electric vehicle is seen as being more of a necessity, right? You know, for day-to-day activities, so on and so forth. But an electric bike is really viewed as more of a luxury item. So, you know, so that's not to say that the adoption rate isn't there. It is increasing as more and more bikes become available, and the price points tend to be dropping a little bit because, you know, they're getting a little bit more competitive. It's interesting because companies like Harley Davidson, BMW, Indian Motorcycles, now these are big names in you know, the gas-powered motorcycle industry, and they have been for decades. And even those companies are recognizing that, you know, the interest in electric motorcycles is increasing. And soon it will probably be increasing at a much more dramatic rate. But right now it's kind of a slow ramp. But with that being said, these companies are actually investing pretty heavily in electric motorcycle technology because they recognize this is the wave of the future. But it's interesting that when you were saying that, you know, Richard was talking about the ICE bike being a collectible, I can see that happening, and maybe not in the near future, but maybe in the distant future. But it's something to keep an eye on because electric bikes, you know, we'll be talking about this later on, and you'll hear it during the podcast itself, that there is some definite features within the electric bike that make them so much more desirable than their counterparts, the ICE bike. So again, vintage, maybe eventually down the road, but after all, I mean, think about it, everything kind of is vintage, including bell-bottom jeans and vinyl records. So, you know, they all have a place in American history.
Do they also have a place in your closet, Joe? Am I hearing something about those bell-bottom jeans?
I can't wear and tell. I'm not going to do that.
But all right, fair enough. Fair enough. Yeah, you know, after listening to Richard, he seems to be somewhat of a visionary, and you know, apparently his business was not far from where Tesla's got started. And I understand they did have a cup of coffee on occasion and exchange some ideas. I mean, to the point where he says he remembers his first ride on an electric bike. And he knew years ago that this would be the wave of the future. So here he is kind of leading the charge. So I see him as someone who really understands what it takes to engineer a world-class electric engine.
Yeah, I mean, just like electric vehicles, like, you know, vehicles themselves, cars, electric motorcycle OEMs like Lightning Motorcycles, you know, they have to place a lot of emphasis on size and weight and their design for obvious reasons. You know, and actually, motorcycles have a much more stringent requirement because, you know, the smaller form factor and the constant exposure to the outside environment, you know, unlike vehicles, which you can shield yourselves from that, but electric motorcycles can't do that. And, you know, electric motorcycle designers like Lightning ultimately need to use every square inch of space, which means they need the most power-dense power solution available to generate and distribute the power that they have. So that's why it makes sense for them to choose Vicor and their design, because Vicor has, you know, their patented modules offer the highest power density rating in the world, making them ultimately the perfect solution for this type of high-performance application.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I do know that they use the DCM4623, which has a very wide input range to accommodate 200 volts to 400 volt battery. And that's important because it really gives them a flexibility to change out the battery. I mean, we know that it's kind of a battery revolution going on right now, or maybe I should say a battery evolution. Things are always changing, and it gives them the flexibility to swap out a battery and yet not change everything else, right? Flexibility is really important for the way they design. You know, additionally, it really does generate a very clean 12-volt supply down to the bike's control electronics, where we're powering the dashboard instrumentation, lighting and sensors, etc. So size and weight is really critical for what they do. But, you know, with that as the backdrop, what do you say we take a little bit of time and listen in to David and Richard have a conversation?
Hello and welcome. Today, I'm here with Richard Hatfield, founder and CEO of Lightning Motorcycle. Welcome, Richard.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So, Richard, if we could just start off by maybe if you could explain to us a little bit about Lightning Motorcycle.
So Lightning Motorcycle produces the most technologically advanced, highest performance, longest range, fastest charging electric motorcycles that are available to the public.
Now, most people are, I'd say, relatively familiar with electric vehicles in terms of passenger cars, maybe less so in terms of electrified two-wheelers or motorcycles. Can you describe a little bit what the challenges or differences are between designing an electrified motorcycle versus a passenger car?
Sure. So some of the main challenges with designing and producing electric motorcycles is the peak power requirements to be similar to that of the top gasoline motorcycles. The power is similar to that of many electric cars, but the size that you're fitting all of this drive system in is a fraction of the size, and the weight is a fraction of the weight. So you have, you know, all of the challenges of packaging and weight and thermodynamics in a much smaller envelope.
So size, I'm assuming that a big element of size and weight is the battery itself. How big is that battery in terms of the voltage and the wattage for a typical two-wheeler or for one of the ones that you've designed?
Yeah, so a typical battery in one of our bikes is in the 20 to 24 kilowatt hour range. Again, similar to some of the early electric cars. And the weight of that is in the, you know, 180 to slightly over 200 pounds. So close to 40%, 45% of the weight of the overall vehicle.
And what would the weight have been in, or how does the weight then compare to a standard internal combustion engine or ICE motorcycle?
So the weight of our bikes is very similar to the weight of a comparable ICE vehicle in a similar segment.
So then thinking a little bit more about the differences between these, obviously the battery in a car is evolving over time, whereas perhaps fuel doesn't really evolve over time. I'm assuming that over time, we're talking about batteries becoming more efficient, maybe packing more power into the same space. What do you see as being, I'd say, the trade-off in the long term in terms of, are you looking for more range as batteries evolve? Are you looking for more power as batteries evolve?
Yeah, the answer is yes. So, you know, constantly being able to reduce the size of the battery pack, the weight of the battery pack, while increasing the range, increasing the output, decreasing the charge time, and decreasing the cost. And then, of course, there's cycle life and there's thermal tolerance as well. You want a battery that can be comfortable in some of the hottest weather that you would operate a bike in, and also some of the coldest weather, which, you know, it is an advantage over a car in that typically motorcycles are operated in a narrower thermal environment than cars are.
Let's talk a little bit about the power and the power source in particular. Can you tell us a little bit about the types of battery or the size of the battery that you're using in terms of the power capacity and maybe even the voltage of the battery?
Sure. So we use a lot of different types of batteries based on the use case of that particular vehicle. You know, we have standard batteries, but we're constantly testing new batteries because that, you know, is one of the prime determinants of the overall user experience for the bike. So a typical battery is somewhere between 60 kilos and 90 kilos. Our typical battery size is between 20 and 23 kilowatt hours, so similar to some of the early electric cars. And the typical voltage we have is in the 3 to 400 volt range, although we have produced some bikes with 800 volt battery packs.
And how do the people that own these bikes, how do they charge it? With passenger vehicles, typically it's done at home. They have an AC unit that charges it. But on the road, they're using these DC fast chargers. Are your bikes compatible with the same DC fast charging systems that are out there for passenger vehicles?
Yeah, our bikes are fully compatible with all the car DC fast systems. And so CCS or J1772 are the most typical, with the NACS now becoming more widely used.
And then thinking a little bit more about the battery, you've got the battery, I'm assuming, doing double duty. It's driving the motor, so it's driving the propulsion of the bike, and then all the other systems. There must be some interesting trade-offs that you have to make to be able to get the peak power to get to some of the speeds that you're able to achieve, while also being able to provide, you know, some of the more creature comforts on the bike.
From the battery perspective, the traction motor, the drive system, is the biggest challenge. The low voltage systems that are also ran from the DC to DC that's on the bike are not nearly as demanding as the, you know, power of the traction. But again, we have the same issue. It, you know, weight is our enemy. Size is the enemy. So, you know, heat. So we have to, we're always considering, you know, packaging and weight and thermal performance.
Can you talk a little bit about the thermal performance? You're generating, I assume, a considerable amount of heat, and you need to somehow dissipate that heat in some way. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, that's a big part of our development, you know, over the last 15 years, is dealing with heat, dealing with the thermal issues of the bike in general, and still maintaining the size and the weight that's required to compete with the, you know, similar ICE vehicles. So we can use oil cooling within the motor, typical liquid cooling within the power electronics, air cooling with the batteries and some of the other components. And anytime that we're doing air cooling, then we also have the issues with moisture and environmental ingress and corrosion and all of those types of issues. So like all engineering, it's optimizing the compromise.
And can you say a little bit about the electrical system? Obviously, you've got to, and this is what's near and dear to our heart here at Vicor, the conversion of the battery power into these different systems. What kind of challenges do you face with that? And especially since you're trying to, as you said, minimize the size and the overall weight of the solution.
Yeah. So, you know, one of the real keys is consistency. Any kind of dropout or variation in voltage or current on our low voltage systems can have a dramatic impact on the overall drive system. We can cause the vehicle to not perform correctly or to fault out. Again, you know, weight, size, heat, packaging, it is really critical. And that's where our relationship with Vicor has been great. Your DCM families of DC to DCs have really solved those issues for us. The power is consistent. The heat is very easy to deal with, and they're very, very small.
That's great to hear. And of course, we enjoy and take great pride in collaborating with companies like Lightning Motorcycle that are so innovative. And speaking of that innovation, your bikes hold the record, the land speed record for motorcycles. And I'm curious, what is it about an EV bike that makes it faster than an ICE bike?
That's a complicated question. So, of course, you know, power is critical, but how power is delivered is also very critical. So when you have a power pulse going to the rear wheel, that power pulse tends to have, you know, intervals of higher acceleration, which can cause a lack of traction. So, You know, if you think about driving in a low traction environment like snow or ice, once the tires start spinning, you really have to, you know, get out of the power to regain traction. And so when you think about the power pulse with a typical ICE engine, you're really limited by the peaks of those pulses by how much traction you have. Where with an electric drive system, the peak of the power pulse and the mean is very close. So we're able to put down more consistent power. And with a, you know, a top speed event, a land speed record, particularly on salt, like in Bonneville, you're limited. If you have enough power, your maximum speed is where the traction equals the aerodynamic drag. So being able to push that torque peak up closer to what the maximum traction is very useful for gaining that last amount of speed. And then the other thing, just aerodynamics, you know, having a smaller overall frontal area and a more aerodynamic package pays dividends. Like most things in engineering, it's not one thing, but it's a combination of things that allows it. But there are some, I think, you know, pretty well accepted at this point, advantages with an electric drive system over an ICE system.
Is it a sense of it's giving you more degrees of freedom to be able to do things like the aerodynamics and other things that you might be more constrained with in a typical ICE system?
Sure. So if you have a very high performance ICE bike, you know, with a turbocharger, you know, something that's making, you know, 250, 350 horsepower, the overall efficiency, thermodynamic efficiency of that is well under 20%. So it means you need a lot of cooling, even for a short run of a minute and a half or 2 minutes for a land speed run, which means you have to direct a lot of air through the heat exchanger, the cooling system of the vehicle. And that air directed is drag, where the overall efficiency of an electric drive system, you know, can be in the upper 80s or even up into the 90s, even when you're making very high power.
So Richard, Lightning Motorcycle holds the land speed record for the fastest motorcycle. How does that translate to developing, designing, and building motorcycles for the consumer market?
So what we learn in competition translates directly to making better motorcycles for our consumers. So what we learn at the Bonneville Salt Flats in aerodynamics and high power output, the aerodynamic lessons that we learn, we transfer those to our production bike. And the majority of the energy used on a bike on highway speeds is to push a hole in the air and bring the rider through that. So by making the bike more aerodynamic, a lot of small changes that we make means the bike can go farther on less battery, more efficiently, and cost less. We were the first electric vehicle company to compete and win at a top international racing event. And so we raced at the Pikes Peak International Hill Climb in the Unlimited Open class, and we won first overall, winning against the second place team out of 110 gas bikes. We were more than 20 seconds ahead of the second place team. And again, what we learned in that process transfers directly to the bikes that our consumers purchase. We also raced at the FIM World Championship race at Le Mans, France, and we won that. So in competition, we challenge ourselves and our engineering capabilities to be the best in the world. And by developing those capabilities in-house, we can then take what we learn and apply it to the bikes that our consumers receive. And it makes for a better product. And the side benefit of that is the consumer knows that they have a product that the DNA came from, you know, world-class competition bikes.
So one other question I have with regard to batteries is battery technology is evolving, and we're seeing a higher density of power in newer technologies of batteries. Presumably that gives you the option to get more range, maybe to achieve faster speeds. What is the trade-off that you're looking for? What do you have to pick one, or is everything what you're trying to go for here?
So it really depends on the use case of that particular vehicle. So if someone is buying a vehicle to do, you know, long distance rides, you know, a dual sport type bike where they're heading off for, you know, long weekends or weeks to enjoy the ride, then range is very important. You know, more energy density, keep the weight down and have more range. But then also being able to charge quick is important. You know, if somebody is going to do several charges during the ride, being able to charge in, you know, 10 minutes versus an hour or multiple hours has a big impact on the experience. If someone is doing a lot of performance riding in the canyons or the hills or even on a track, then that power density and thermal management is important. And then you have all the other factors that you have to evaluate as well, which is, you know, how does it perform in high and low temperatures? How does the battery perform power-wise when it's in a low state of charge? How many cycles can you expect to get out of it? Then, of course, the big one is, what is the cost? What kind of premium are you paying for that extra ability of the battery?
So once again, maybe I'm oversimplifying, but it does seem like that as battery technologies improve, you have, once again, more degrees of freedom. You can expand your portfolio, design more bikes that meet the needs of more types of riders to accommodate whatever their use is. It does seem like that notion of degrees of freedom plays again here as well.
Absolutely. When we built the first lithium sport bike in 2006, the best lithium batteries we could get were not even 100 watt hours per kilogram, where now 300 watt hours per kilogram is you know, readily available, you know, with fast charge capability and thermal tolerance and, you know, good cycle life. So, you know, we're just in the last 16 or 17 years, the batteries have come so far. I mean, literally a third of the weight and, you know, more power, just, you know, everything better. And with some of the new cutting edge batteries we're now testing, we're very, very optimistic about where this is going to go. And, you know, we can see a future not that far off where people will collect ice bikes as, you know, great collectibles rather than being their, you know, the mainstay in the market.
Well, I look forward to that day. It certainly looks like the products that you have engineered are, as I mentioned at the beginning, very innovative, and we're happy that we can be part of that innovation with you. Thank you very much for your time today. I really appreciate you sharing some of these insights around this technology with us. Thank you very much.
Great. Again, thanks for having us.
So I thought David did a real nice job of digging into some of the more technical details with Richard. You know, Richard really knows his stuff, very impressive guy. But what I was most impressed with is, you know, his real desire, he said, is to deliver a world-class ride. And yet he also has achieved the land speed record. And nothing captures like the world-class ride concept as well as this quote from him. He says, "The bike gives you a feeling of limitless torque with no vibration, no noise, and no heat. There's an almost magical feel to it." So to me, that speaks highly and very directly to his world-class ride that he's trying to achieve. And yet I see a dichotomy there, because when you go fast, I know my car rattles at 65 miles an hour. So how he can achieve both of them, to me, is an amazing engineering feat. I don't know if I'd like to hear your thoughts on that, Joe, because that's really impressive in my mind.
Yeah, when you said magical, I was thinking, for some reason it came to mind, he was riding a unicorn, an electric unicorn, but I'm not sure if that's possible. But I'm sure if it was, I'm sure a Lightning motorcycle would be able to design it. But, you know, if we put aside the history and the nostalgia associated with ice bikes, and face it, throughout the American history, you know, ice bikes have been romanticized in movies and in books. So, you know, but if we put that aside for the time being and we just look at the raw performance, the numbers, you know, comparing when we compare electric motorcycles to ice bikes, I think you'll recognize that electric motorcycles win hands down. So I have five brief points that I think will convince the listeners of that electric motorcycles are much better than the ice bikes. So the first one, and I think the most important one, is the fact that you get instantaneous torque and power off the line. I mean, there's no need to wait for the transmission and the engine to get up to full RPM, like, you know, what happens in ice bikes. And it's just, it's the nature of the mechanism. Number two is routine maintenance. As we all know, I think we're all familiar with gas-powered engines and the level of maintenance that's required, you know, lubrication, just spark plugs and everything else that goes along with it. So electric motorcycles do not have that routine maintenance issue because their electric motors are direct drive. So there's no lubricants, there's no valves and stems and all the other bit parts that come along with an ice bike. The third, and which is obvious, is less noise pollution. You know, we've all been in traffic on a roadway where the ice bikes come by or they're idling right next to you and you can't even hear your radio. So the decibel level for ice bikes are much higher than they are for electric motorcycles. And a very important thing that people may not consider, but when you're riding the bike, you do, it's the wear and tear on the driver. So on an ice bike, you know, when you're idling, the bike's shaking, there's a lot of noise, there's a lot of heat. I mean, literally, you're sitting on top of the engine. So there's all that heat that's coming up. So if you're sitting in traffic, it's not a very good user experience. So the user experience for the driver on an electric motorcycle is so much better than that on an ice bike. And then finally, which is obvious, it's better for the environment, right? So there's no gas emissions. It's all electric. There's no CO2 emitted. The carbon footprint is zero. So, you know, you can drive the bike and feel comfortable that you're not contributing negatively to the environment around you. So you can really, truly just enjoy the riding experience that Richard talked about. So I think those 5 points alone would hopefully convince everybody that electric motorcycles are much better than ice bikes.
Yeah, so I can see, Joe, there's a huge draw to going electric. I mean, those are some great points that you make. I particularly can relate to the point about the road wear and tear on a driver. I mean, I've driven a motorboat several times before, and if you're out there for a few hours and as a driver, you actually get a little more tired than normal, and it is because of that vibration, that constant vibration. Like you said, with a bike, you're sitting on top of the engine, so it makes a lot of sense. You know, another point that Richard made that was a little quizzical to me and I'm trying to figure out was he was talking about why they were so successful at the Pikes Peak race. And he mentioned that electric bikes get better traction than ice bikes. And I never knew that. Any light you can shed on that topic?
Yeah, I heard the same thing during the interview with Richard. And I wanted to do a little digging into that because traction, you know, typically it can be a misunderstood term. So I wanted to get a little bit of the science behind the term. And, you know, in a nutshell, it's really all about, you know, what traction is. It's all about providing a consistent and smooth power to the wheels. With ice bikes, they use, you know, they use a typical standard transmission that we're all familiar with. And what happens is as it goes through the different gears, that introduces a spike in power. And what that does is that introduces slippage, right? So you don't have that smooth curve that electric motorcycles do. Electric motorcycles with the direct drive engine provide a smooth curve, so you don't have any slippage. It's all pure traction. And that's where the advantage is, and that's why they did so well on that race. But if we look at it in reverse, right? So I look at this like, if we look at the anti-lock braking system in a vehicle, and we're all pretty familiar with those because they've been around for decades now. So an anti-lock braking system is the same exact concept, but in reverse. So it's what it's doing is it's providing a smooth curve, transitional curve for deceleration in a vehicle, as opposed to with the electric motorcycle, and that's a smooth acceleration. So, but it's the same concept. It's about maintaining constant traction on the road surface. So with the ABS system, we all hear that rapid noise, and basically that's the brake pads tapping the brake pad. And it's what it's doing is it's slowing down the vehicle at a controlled rate. Whereas opposed to if we didn't have that, we would stomp on the brake and that would spike and then we'd have slippage and we'd lose traction. So that's how I kind of rationalize or understand traction a little bit better.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is a good definition and a great description in terms of the anti-lock braking, right? That really makes a lot of sense in terms of we can all relate to that, especially with some of the slippery roads we have around here these days.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a great response on that. Hopefully our listeners learned something. I know myself, I learned something from the podcast. I don't think the ice bikes will be collectibles anytime soon, but I do see a strong inertia, shall we say, as to how quickly the electric motorcycles are coming along. So With that said, that's all we have time for today.
So until next time, I'm Steve Germino with my co-host Joe Ducey. Thanks for tuning in to the Vicor Powering Innovation Podcast.